This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, are you ready to talk about the first original novel of Deep Space Nine by Peter David, The Siege? You told me that we were going to talk about The Siege. I had to make time to read the book, so I'm set. I'm ready to go.
Chris, this isn't literary treks. This is The Orb. What? We're going to...
Oh, I know. But I thought we were doing The Siege, the Deep Space Nine novel by Peter David.
No. We're going to talk about the episode, The Siege, so we can finish up the Circle Trilogy. Remember?
Damn you, Memory Alpha! Oh, wait. What does it say here? For the DS9 episode with a similar title, please see The Siege. Oh, man.
Sorry about that. I didn't mean to make you read a book, Chris, that you didn't need to read when you could have been reading something else.
All right. Well, I've seen this episode before, and I believe the book, there was this giant spider that ran by, and I thought, is that a spider or a dog? And so I thought that I was on the right track. I really screwed up.
No, Chris, that's a palooka.
I hear those are tasty.
Well, if you have enough sriracha sauce, so you really need, you know, like Richard around or Norm, maybe Will, because I think they just carry it around instead of like a six shooter. They just have sriracha sauce right there in a holster.
I'm picturing the Bajoran Council now with bottles of sriracha on the table. It's like Bajoran sriracha.
It works well with a nice spring wine.
Oh, that's good. All right. So we're actually going to talk about the episode, The Siege, the third part of the Circle Trilogy, and we're going to wrap up our look at the Circle Trilogy. Now, Matthew, before we do that, this week I've been doing a lot of behind-the-scenes work on the network because we've migrated to a new hosting platform and distribution platform. And I had some questions for you because I need some help here. Matthew, do any of your past hosts have experience applying a 20-band equalizer to an audio track recorded with a webcam mic?
My current host does with its experience, extensive experience at this point with Audition. So you're in luck.
Okay, good. Well, let me also ask you, Matthew, do any of your past hosts have experience debugging JavaScript code used to automate the delivery of supplemental podcast material?
That is a no.
So did you not think it was funny when Sisko turns to Jadzia and asks this really super specific technical question about her past hosts?
It was really funny. it made me...
Because it was so specific. It was so detailed.
It made me think that it was more that Sisko kind of remembered something about a past host, and that's why he could get that specific, because Curzon probably told him about all the hosts, and it was just kind of... One of your Maybe. Hosts does this, right? Did this.
Right.
Yeah, but it was very... it was a nice use of the trill, honestly, I thought. I think, you know, you've set this up, so it's not really a cheat when you use it.
True, true. But it felt like early Deep Space Nine there. Mm-hmm. That felt like something they would say on the Next Generation, not something that you would hear them write later on in DS9 when they really got more away from all that techno babble and technical detail.
Yeah, I feel like in an old episode that happens. I feel like it, as you go later on, Dax probably just speaks up at that point. She's like, I could do that. I could do that. I can do that.
I think Sisko would just ask, Dax, do any of your past hosts have experience fixing stuff?
Yeah.
And, you know, keep it simple.
Yeah, keep it simple, stupid. I mean, keep seriously.
All right. Well, before we get into the real discussion here, I would like to take a moment and remind everyone, if you're listening to The Orb and you're not familiar with all the other shows that we have on the network, we have so many shows for you covering every Star Trek series, as well as all sorts of topics surrounding Star Trek and even beyond, even other geek topics on Matthew's 602 Club.
Beyond!
That's right. Beyond Star Trek. So please go check out all of our shows. If you are an Apple user, you can go to itunes.com/trekfm, and that'll take you into our artist section, both on the desktop and on your mobile device. If you're an Android user, just go to trek.fm and go to the show pages. You can get the RSS link there, or look in a third-party podcast app and search for trek.fm, and you'll find all of our shows there. And we hope you'll check out everything we have for you here on the network. Okay, Matthew, let's start out by talking about character moments here as we get into the third part of this trilogy. And there are a lot of really great ones in here. I was really impressed how, in the midst of a story about a coup d'etat, it's French, by the way.
Stupid French thing. I love that Nog's like, right? No, no stupid French thing's going to break us up.
And then he gives Jake a big hug.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really nice moment, actually.
It is. What I'm impressed with is how, in the midst of this, they put so much humor into this episode. There are so many great, light, and fun character moments while they're facing an occupation of the station, the possibility that they're going to be marooned on a moon and have to eat giant spiders, and who knows what else is going to happen to them. And yet we have Quark making business deals to sell seats on runabouts for an evacuation. You've got Odo turning into the most incredible things he's ever turned into. And you've got great banter between Jadzia and Kira. And as you mentioned before we started recording, on the other side of the orb, a little bit of bromance brewing.
Well, Chris, gosh, there's so many. Okay, let's start, I think, with Jadzia and Kira. They, this is such a great episode for them. It's really the first time I feel like that they're just like buddy-buddy. Like, they're besties at this point, and they're heading off to a moon together, and not sure if they're going to come back. And everything that they're doing is this wonderful, like, back and forth banter, you know? It almost, Kira almost seems like the old fogey who's telling the youngin' to, you know, simmer down and stop, right, you know, whining about not having certain technologies, which is a nice role reversal for them, I think. So that's one of the things I think that makes it so funny. Yeah, and it just seems like every single person, even though this is a serious episode, they're having a lot of fun with the storyline here. Mm-hmm. And it really, I think, goes to prove the point that Deep Space Nine tells some serious stories, but a lot of times it does it with some very funny stuff. And this episode is just rife with great lines, specifically in this storyline with Kira and Dax.
I felt like here that Kira is the voice of the writers, like Ron and Ira, and the DS9 staff itself deciding that they're going to move away from the technology and the technobabble of the Next Generation. we really don't necessarily see that completely yet in the writing and in the series, but we know that DS9 heads in that direction. And here you've got Kira, the character who isn't from Starfleet, saying, you know, you guys are too dependent on your technology. You've got to be able to take care of yourself in the real world without having everything automated for you all the time.
Yeah, I love that. And it's very funny to watch even somebody as smart as Dax. You know, she makes it work. She's just going to complain about it, you know.
but in a cute way.
Yeah, exactly. And she really, I mean, yeah, she's very adorable in this episode. And I really like that they have this whole relationship that doesn't revolve around them, you know, being the girly girls. They're just great friends, and it's a good relationship. And I do wish we saw even more of this, the kind of the way that you grow to see more Miles and Julian. I just, this is, they do it well on Deep Space Nine, friendship, especially between male friendship and female friendship. It's great. I really like it. And they just showed that you can really nail it.
While we're on this topic of Dax and Kira, I do want to talk about the ship a little bit that they go to the Lunar 5 colony to get. Would you actually climb in that and fly in space? Didn't it feel a little bit like the spaceship equivalent of, say, a Yugo or a Lekar?
I think that actually is the bumper sticker on the back. Yugo of the 24th century. So
maybe. See, I had a friend when I was in high school who had a Yugo. And what I remember three things about this car. I remember that the key broke off in the ignition and he had to solder a screwdriver onto the broken off key so he could turn that to start the
That's
car.
That's awesome.
I remember that the front seat, it didn't recline forward the way that a normal car seat would. The entire seat just lifted up and went forward.
Well, that's kind of helpful,
retained,
right?
The shape.
Oh,
right?
Okay. Yeah.
It retained the same shape.
Oh, gosh.
And the whole thing just came forward. And also, when you open the door, it actually would open all the way around until it was flush with the front end of the car.
That doesn't seem safe. I don't. Yeah.
But so when they climb in here and they're trying to get the gull wing, it's like, it seemed like a DeLorean kind of gull wing thing they had going here, right? In the ship. And when they're trying to pull that down and they have to keep pulling and pulling, I'm thinking, that can't possibly be sealed. And they're going to fly this thing through space?
Yeah, it seems like a bad idea, Chris. I love it, though, because Kira's like, oh, I've been in worse than this, you know.
Right.
Let's just hope this baby, you know, stay. It almost was like they're in the Millennium Falcon and she's like, Hold on, baby. Just stay together a little bit longer.
right. It felt like that. Except at least the Millennium Falcon is large.
That is true.
It's not like a tiny capsule like this thing is.
Yeah, it's a tiny, anyway, tiny ship. You don't have to yell.
Yeah, the ship really cracked me up.
Oh, gosh.
All right. Well, I want to talk about Odo real quick because this is the episode where Odo turns into the most awesome thing that he ever turns into, ever on Deep Space Nine, a tripwire.
It's pretty cool.
He actually turns into a tripwire to trip somebody running down the corridor. How awesome is that?
I mean, it just shows the imagination. I mean, apparently being a changeling is like being a Green Lantern. You know, you can just turn yourself into whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. If you need a tripwire, you could become a tripwire. So I love that. It's hilarious. Good use of Odo with the writers to give you, again, an interesting look at what changelings can do, but in a very humorous way.
In a humorous way. And you don't see them do things like that very often, especially not later on. You know, he doesn't change into as many shapes, I feel like, as maybe they originally thought he would, probably because of the cost of the effects and such. But things like the tripwire really crack me up, and it makes me think, if they're trapped somewhere high, why doesn't he turn into a rope so people can climb down him? Or if Miles needs a spanner to fix something and there's no spanner available, can't Odo just become a spanner?
See, these are all great questions to which we need answers. I need a canon novel about this. Maybe we should talk to David A. Goodman about that. Maybe that can be his next work about all the things that changelings can become. I do think that it is mainly the cost. And almost sometimes I feel like the writers kind of forget that Odo's a changeling, that he can do this stuff. So it's like the transporter. We can get people out of situations pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, do you think that's because, especially as the series goes on, we're starting to get into it in season two, but certainly with the coming seasons we will, the way they approach the storytelling, it's so much about the characters and their relationships and things that we can relate to as humans. And I can't relate to the ability to turn into a chair or something else that I want to turn into. And so the fact that he is a shapeshifter just doesn't have that much use in the storytelling as they go along. Or they just don't think about incorporating it because it's more of a sci-fi element, whereas Deep Space Nine is less of that type of show than the other Star Trek series are?
That's a really good question. I don't know if it is them forgetting or if it really did just come down to the kind of the budgetary issue. I mean, do you realize how much that tripwire cost them on this episode? I mean,
right.
It's like $1 million tripwire. So,
well, it makes you wonder if DS9 were made today, how often would we see Odo changing shapes? Because they could do it today very easily, whatever effect they want, it's no problem. But back then, that was a major undertaking.
I mean, you know how Game of Thrones has nudity every 5 seconds? I'm pretty sure if we had Deep Space Nine today, it would be Odo just changing into things every 5 seconds. Because, hey, look what we can do.
I thought you were going to say that Odo would be nude all the time.
Oh, no.
On the show,
no.
And that's not where
you
were going.
He just kind of looks like a Ken doll, so it would be okay.
I would be right. All right. So that's Odo I wanted to talk about. Quark. Quark is in rare form here. I guess I shouldn't say rare form, maybe
he's
true
in Quark
to Ferengi of the Time form,
yes,
where
yes,
he's looking for the business deal. And Rom is still like proto-Rom to me here. You know, Rom becomes a really great character, but early in the show, Rom doesn't, I don't know, he's just Quark's brother, right? And he's trying to play the Ferengi that we're familiar with more or less. Not the Last Outpost Ferengi, but just the greedy Ferengi.
No laser whips involved, people. No
right,
laser whips.
Right. And no fur.
Thank God.
So now I'm picturing the nude Odo wearing fur. No, we don't need that on the show.
I'm sorry, but listeners. Chris, get your mind out of the gutter and back into the show.
It's not in the gutter. I mean, I don't mean anything like that. I'm just saying it just, you never know. I mean, if you're a shapeshifter,
they've got a whole different set of values. So
that's right. But Quark and Rom, I mean, what did you think about this part of the story?
I love that Rom is the one that swindles Quark in the end. He takes
right?
a seat
cool.
and a Dabo girl. You know, it's like, so Rom's off on Bajor getting lucky, and Quark is left on the station trying to lug around his family valuables, otherwise known as Latinum.
Right. And plus, Rom left with a Dabo girl who is, I'm pretty sure, a Bajoran. After Lee Nowlis told all the Bajorans, we should stay here, these shuttles are for our friends who need to leave.
He's a smooth talker, that Rom. I mean, how do you think he ends up getting the Bajoran girl Lita in the end? Yeah. So, I mean, the guy's got moves we've never seen, apparently, because we never see them on the show after this.
When it comes to Lita, I think Rom turns out to be a nice and caring person, and that's why Lita likes him.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, we were just talking on Literary Treks, Dan and I, about Ferenginar, the World of Deep Space Nine book, and there's a whole speech that Quark gives about his brother Rom and how he is a nice person, and that's what sets him apart. He would never do anything to hurt anyone. I guess he forgot this little incident because it was a mere blip. You know, one of the few times Rom really became the true Ferengi.
Right. Or maybe he just did it to get back at his brother because he was just really ticked off at his brother.
That's probably more like it. It probably wasn't anything like truly deviously Ferengi-ish. It was just, I'm getting back at my brother.
Well, Quark admitted that he would actually give up his brother's life if it were for the deal of a lifetime.
Isn't that a rule of acquisition? You know, don't let family stand in the way of profit.
I'm pretty sure it is. I don't know which number, but I do know that rule of acquisition number 31 is never make fun of a Ferengi's mother.
Which is weird because that's all Quark likes to do with his mother. So maybe it's a Ferengi can make fun of his own mom, but when you cross the line of somebody else making fun of your Moogie, yeah, that's unacceptable.
That's right.
Well, Chris, I really liked in this episode, and I thought there's this whole scene where they're going to capture some of the militia that have come on the station. And O'Brien...
Can I interrupt you one second before we leave Odo and Quark and all? Because it ties into what you're talking about right now. When the militia's walking down the corridor and Odo is sticking out of the wall, was Odo the wall or is he like Casper the Friendly Ghost now who can like go through walls?
No, I think he was just the wall.
He was literally the wall.
Yeah. That's cool. Which is another really cool thing that Odo can do is he can be the wall.
That's right. Be the wall.
No. Not like the Pink Floyd wall.
Oh. Okay, so go on with what you were saying.
So there's this great...
The militia's going to take over the station.
There's this great scene and Bashir saying, okay, I can do this. Apparently everybody's Chekhov in this episode. I can do that. And O'Brien is wanting to go help him because I think he just doesn't feel like Bashir has it in him. And Bashir pulls it off beautifully. He captures the guards. And there's this great scene where Sisko and O'Brien look at each other. And I really do feel like that's the moment that kind of the bromance begins. They've had this banter back and forth on their comm badges that are wonderfully masked somehow. Nobody else can communicate in the station, but they can communicate with each other. So good job, O'Brien. And that look, I just feel like O'Brien has a new respect for Julian that he just didn't have before. And it was just a nice little moment. It's a little tiny thing there. But I do feel like, you know, a bromance is born.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I didn't really pick up on it as much myself. I wasn't looking for it. But now that you mention it, next time I watch this, I'm going to go back and see if I pick up on that.
What did you think? And I thought this was kind of cool that there's a great moment in there with Sisko and Jake. That Sisko is worried, you know, both Sisko and O'Brien, they're nice mirrors for each other because they're both worried about their families, but they're doing what they know is right. And I thought it was really interesting to both see them deal with seeing off their families and you know, I mean, he's the last parent that this kid has.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really nice, really well done scene. And you could just tell so much how close that Avery and Serac have become even by the second season.
Yeah. I felt like when Jake goes through the airlock, though, it felt a little bit too easy to me. You know, I have been in that position where I, one time when we were moving and we moved from Japan to the States for a while. And my son was really small at that time, and I had to actually go by myself for a few months. And so I had to leave my very small son behind, of course, with his mom. But I know what that felt like. And here, for Jake leaving, having lost his mother recently, and in this situation, he has to be thinking there is a real possibility that I'm going to lose my father as well. It seemed like it wouldn't have been quite that easy for them to say goodbye and for him to go through the airlock. But of course, for the purpose of the story, you've got to move the story along because that's not what the story is about.
Yeah.
But I do think they could have played that up a little bit more, because I think that would have been a really, really difficult moment for Jake, knowing that there's a real chance that I am about to be completely on my own.
It's a tough thing to think about. And I love that they even mention it there, because they're paying attention again, you know, to where these characters are. You know, even Kira says to Dax, I can't believe it. A year ago, I was in a place just like this, you know, and how much has changed for these characters. So they really are cognizant of where they are in the timeline of the characters. And I think that's great.
Yeah. With Miles and Keiko, did you feel like... I kind of think that Keiko comes off poorly again, as she usually does on the show, because she says they can have the whole Gamma Quadrant for all I care. It just feels like she should care a little bit more about the Bajorans and other people who maybe she doesn't even know. I think that most of us would feel that way if someone, like if an entire civilization were being threatened, but it doesn't seem to bother her. She just wants Miles to go with her. And then also with Miles at this point, do you think he cares as much about protecting the Bajorans and protecting the wormhole, or he just doesn't want the Cardassians to have it because of his past history, which they use to set up the character, but they don't really tell us that much about?
That's tough. I think that Miles is just a soldier. He wants to do the right thing, and he sees the right thing here being to expose the lie. And I love the scene that Sisko has there in Ops, because it's a great moment where he's talking about how their lives over the last years have become intertwined with the Bajorans. You know, they're all in this together at this point. And I agree with you. I was struggling with that scene with Keiko because I didn't understand how she could feel like that when she teaches a school with all of these Bajoran children. Right. And she also is married to a Starfleet officer. She understands. She's been on a starship before, the Enterprise. Exactly. They've been in danger. You know, it didn't make sense. You know, my wife was in the Army, and she's just gotten out of the Army and will be moving to the National Guard. But even though she's in the National Guard, there's always a possibility that she could leave again. And we understand that, you know, that can always happen. So it's a part of the life of the service. And I was a little bit disappointed that she came off like that.
Yeah.
Because instead of seeming progressive or anything, it just kind of comes off as being a little bit like whiny and naggy. And I don't feel like that Keiko would be that person. And she isn't always necessarily that person. And it didn't seem to fit. Like, you know, Keiko doesn't play on the show a lot. Kind of think they forget sometimes about her character development a little bit.
Well, yeah, they do. And we talk often about how Miles and Keiko are the most real couple that we see in Star Trek. And I do think that's true. And I do think a spouse would exhibit some of the sentiment that Keiko does in that situation sometimes, but not to the extent that she usually does. I think that the way they write her is too often the nagging spouse instead of the spouse who's really in a partnership where you're really working together and you're really understanding what the other person needs to do and the situations, especially if they've been together as long as they have. And like you said, she is a military spouse and she's lived on the Enterprise and now she's lived on the station, and it's certainly been long enough that she should understand the situation a little bit better. So I don't know. I just wish they would write her. I wish they had written her better throughout the show.
And the danger here is pretty minimal. I mean, the Bajorans aren't going to be coming in here shooting to kill. Disintegrations.
Yeah, they're just going to come in and style your hair for you, man.
Yeah, they're going to stun you. You know, it's not as though the danger here is deadly, I don't think.
Well, do you think that they try to present it as if it is? Like, I don't think that Starfleet would have any fear whatsoever of the Bajoran militia, but the way the story is set up, they do kind of try to make it feel like the station is about to be invaded by people with really great hair.
I do feel like that they're ramping up the tension, but I think that it might be the threat of the Cardassians becoming involved somehow.
Yeah.
That's where the true danger lies. It's not the militia and their, you know, Vidal Sassoon hair. It's... Right. You know, the fact that the Cardassians might come in at any point because they are behind all of this for a reason that we don't know.
Yeah, could be. All right. Well, okay, let's talk about the hair for a minute just because we're already talking about it. Am I crazy for always talking about how the Bajoran militia has the best hair of any military? Or do you also think that from a styling standpoint, it was a little bit of an odd choice to, they don't feel like a military organization at all. They just feel like, and I don't know, they feel more like models than they do soldiers.
Well, you know, I think one of the things you've noticed about Bajorans is they are all pretty attractive people. And yeah. That's just the way it goes on Bajor. They all have great hair. I mean, that general has, not only does he have this fantastic McDreamy-like hair, but then he has this wonderful uniform that has this amazing kind of fringed shoulder pad on the top.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I mean,
that's the Bajoran militia equivalent of the Admiral belt buckle in Starfleet.
It's fantastic. I mean, I think that he probably made some Starfleet admirals a little bit jealous with the fringe on top.
Probably did. I'd like to see if the Bajoran generals mod their uniforms the way the Starfleet admirals do, and like maybe some of them have like stacked layers of that stuff on their shoulders. Maybe some gold striping.
It starts to look like a Jenga game on their shoulders there.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm largely joking about the hair, everyone. But it did always strike me when they first came on the station. They come out of the airlock and they're walking down the corridor. And I'm like, okay, this is an invasion force? It looks like they just went and they got ready before they came aboard the station. And also seeing Stephen Weber.
Can you pass me the Aquanet?
Yeah, right. And also seeing Stephen Weber as a Bajoran was always interesting to me because this was at the time when Wings was really huge.
Yep. Yeah.
On must-see TV on NBC. And you're always used to seeing him on Wings and seeing him here with his hair slicked back and the Bajoran ridges on his nose as Colonel Day was kind of odd.
Well, you know, Gen Z is thinking about keeping the ridges, so... they're quite becoming.
I think they look good on her.
Yeah.
But then again, everything looks good on her, so.
This is true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go on to some other topics here and get more into the meat of the story. The Navark wakes up in this episode when he finally steps forward to calm the Bajorans who are trying to get on the runabouts to leave the station because there aren't enough seats and everyone's in panic. I don't really know why Bajorans would be in panic to leave the station when the order that has been given by the Bajoran government is for all non-Bajorans to leave the station. So why are all the Bajorans living on the station panicking? But they are. So Lee Nalis steps in, he tells everyone, look, these seats are for our friends. They need to leave. It's not safe for them. We're Bajorans. This is our home. Let's stick together. Let's solve these problems together. And then everyone says, oh, yeah, that's the good idea. Why don't we do that? Everyone except that Dabo girl who left with Rom. But that was maybe the first time where we really saw like the light bulb go on and him be assertive as a leader in this story.
I think that's one of the things that does make this successful is that he finally has something to feel like he's a part of something. Like he can, he takes up that mantle of being the person that everybody thinks he is. And he makes an impassioned speech. He gets everybody to follow him. And, you know, it's a real win for his character and for just him personally, I think. And there's the great moment where, you know, he talks to Sisko and how he's willing to die for what he believes in and his people. And Ben's like, but I need you to live for them right now. That's what's more important. And he finally does that. You know, he finally lives for his people. And it's a really nice scene because I think it's very organic. And I do, you know, even at the beginning of the episode where they're having the funny conversation that we referenced at the very beginning of our show, he mentions that there could be some of those sublight shuttles there on the moon. And he's trying to come up with ideas. You know, he's trying to be involved. So it was very interesting. He's just still uncomfortable because he doesn't really know how he fits in all this.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nicely done, his storyline. And I personally like the way that it rounds out. I think it makes sense and it gives nice closure. And I would argue, too, that, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen the episode, I don't know why you haven't and why you're listening, but...
right. Well, because they read the book, Matthew.
Yeah, that's
true.
The
book by Peter David called The Siege.
Where they learn that Lee Nollis dies at the end by saving Captain Sisko's life and stepping in front of a phaser. And I think he finally gets to be immortalized then too as the hero that Bajor will need and can kind of look to. He'll be not the martyr, but he's, what would you call that, Chris? He's the hero. You know, he's the real true hero.
The hero, yeah. Okay, that's what I wanted to talk about. I think that, yeah, what you say, I agree with, that's the ultimate outcome. I feel like the way it was handled in the story was kind of, it was too much of like a little coda tacked on to the end of the story. Just because, you know, you have those moments in stories where a character sacrifices themselves. And sometimes they do it because there's no other option. You know, and there's a buildup to it. Like Data sacrificing himself in Nemesis, there was a buildup to that. There was nothing else that they could do. And Data wanted to save Picard, and he did. And he gave his life for his friends, and even it wasn't the most perfect execution either, but at least there was a build up to it, and you really understood that, okay, Data has to make this decision. Here, it's just so quick. Like, Colonel Day is going to shoot Sisko, and it's not even obvious, actually, certainly not the first time through, that he's trying to shoot Sisko. Is he trying to kill Sisko because he doesn't want the Federation there? Is he trying to kill Lee Nollis because he doesn't want Lee Nollis around? You don't really know. And also because DS9 is a very dark show, the lighting is dark and it's muddy in standard definition.
Yes, it really is.
You can't quite tell the details of what's going on. And so I feel like it was handled a little bit clumsily. And Peter Allen Fields, who is a producer, he actually didn't like them killing Lee Nollis at all because he said it seemed to me that killing him would just send us back to square one. Why spend 3 episodes with this guy and then let him die? You're back as if he'd never been around. We could have written the whole thing without him. Okay, Peter Allen Field's opinion. And then Iris said, well, no, this completes his arc. He has a moment of true sacrifice and heroism. And also they didn't want him to be a recurring character. But between those two things there, I mean, do you think that his death was necessary, truly necessary at the end? Could they have, especially because it feels kind of like a throwaway moment of action?
I think when I think about it, the way that Ira's talking, it is the culmination of the character's arc. You know, he wasn't the hero that everybody thought he was in real life. It was a made-up legend. But now he actually is the hero that everybody thought he was. And he got to prove it to himself as well. And I think, you know, I don't think Lee Nollis really wanted to live with himself, honestly.
Well, no, neither do I.
And I think this gave him the opportunity to live with himself so he could die with the honor that he had earned. And I think that's that it's that character arc there that they're really thinking about. And of course, you know, and the behind the scenes is they just didn't think they could afford having this actor on so much in the future that they would probably have to use him with. So
Well, and to be honest, I personally did not want to see Lee Nollis continue as a regular character on the show. Now, I know that some of our listeners do. I've seen some people comment about that in the Babel conference before, that they love Lee Nollis and they wish that he had become a regular character. I never felt that way myself.
Right. And, you know, I think that gives them the opportunity on the show to continue to explore this side of Bajor, and as they're trying to figure things out, you know, 7 years later, it's still going to be the provisional government. They move a little slow. It's kind of like trying to promote Harry Kim or Ensign Mayweather.
So the Bajoran government is the Harry Kim of governments.
Pretty much, yeah.
All right.
But let's just put it this way. Almost every death in Star Trek, except for maybe Tasha Yar's, is better than Trip's. So,
well, yeah, of course.
I think even her death is better than Trip's. So, yeah.
That was just a glitch in Riker's holodeck program.
Yeah, definitely. Why did I bring up that episode?
I don't know why you brought that up, but I agree with you.
Yeah.
Well, maybe because we're talking about that Data sacrificing himself and Lee Nollis.
Which I don't really like that either, but at least it's a little bit better than... Yeah. Anyway, that's a whole other podcast.
Okay, that's a whole other discussion.
that's Earl Grey.
Yes, and I'm pretty sure we've discussed that at least twice on The Ready Room, because we've done Nemesis itself, and then we did the TNG movie Showdown as well with the Earl Grey guys. So, but with Lee Nollis, like you said, maybe he didn't want to live with himself. He gets to sacrifice himself at the end. He will be remembered as the hero, which maybe it's good that they had that conversation between Sisko and O'Brien, because O'Brien was saying what we all probably feel is that, and Lee Nollis himself felt, was that I was just this ordinary guy. I wasn't the hero. And O'Brien is about to say, you know, I didn't see any of this legend stuff in him. And Sisko stops him and says, he was a great man. He was a hero. That's how the history books will record the story of Lee Nollis. And sometimes you need those people who are recorded as heroes in the history books with stories that are probably maybe 20% accurate, but they give optimism, and they give comfort to the people of that country or that planet, in the case of Star Trek, to have those people in their history.
Yeah, no, I think he's the hero that Bajor needs, but not necessarily the one that deserves.
There's some big words there. Necessarily.
Yeah. that's probably why he died, to quote Batman there. So,
but I also noticed that Bashir really makes no effort to save him either. Just hold a tricorder over him. Now, maybe the wound was so severe that he knew that there's no way that he could save him. But at the same time, I can see other situations where he'd be tapping and tapping and tapping, and he would be doing everything he can to save this guy. But it's almost like he and Sisko both knew that this is what the Nihilus wants and this is what he needs. So let's just let him go.
Yeah, I mean, but I think if you take any phaser point blank range, there's very little that most medicine can do for you, is my guess.
It was a Bajoran phaser.
Those are extra strong, Chris. I don't think you knew that.
Oh, extra strong, like Vidal Sassoon extra hard wax or gel or something?
Yeah, exactly. Those Bajorans, they're not messing around. They fought the Cardassians off. They know how to make a, you know, phaser.
This is true. All right. All right, so where are we on Lee Nihilus? Ultimately, it closes his arc. And it closes his arc successfully as a story. Maybe the execution could have been a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I've never had a huge issue at all with the acting or the storyline or anything. I thought it was well done, and I always expected that was where they're going to go. Honestly, I never expected Lee Nihilus to be somebody that would stay around. So,
right.
I do have to ask you, Chris. You know, there's we haven't really talked about Jero or Wynn, and she's not Kai yet, but it struck me that it was a great moment. We could have had the Deep Space Nine musical episode, you know, and had a nice little Grease moment, you know. Evil loving had me a blast. Evil loving happened so fast, you know, because she just dumps him like he dumps Sandy right after the summer. Like, see ya, you know.
Well, as you're singing that, I'm picturing then from the background, like a whole group of Vedics with the Sydney Opera House hats and all in and they start dancing behind that. Yeah.
It would work. And you have the Vedic assembly, which apparently is the smallest room on Bajor, right there. So I like it. It would be great. Actually, that's not really the Vedic assembly. Pardon me before we get notes there, the more orbs. From the Orb of Mail, but that's the provisional government room. And apparently it is quite tiny. Maybe that's the problem, is they had such a small room, they really couldn't govern well, because it's like there's no windows in there or anything. It's just...
There's a plastic sign outside the door that literally says... The provisional government room.
Exactly. It's only provisionally your room. Don't get used to it, folks.
It's like if you're a club and you borrow a room, a small room in the basement of the local civic center in your town of 4,000 people.
That's pretty much what they did, but for a whole planet's government.
Right.
That's
for 7 years.
Yeah. It was a little bit funny. And part of that, I'm sure, is that, you know, the budget is it just doesn't have it expansive. And then, of course, you know, we're not Enterprise. We can't just drop a green screen and give a little set extension. So, no, you can't do any of that. So you have a very dark, muted, tiny room for an entire planet's government to meet in.
Which is funny, because when you see the scenes of the city, right, you've got the big ornate buildings
all.
So you would think that they would have more space in that somewhere.
Well, and then you think of the very end of Deep Space Nine, you know, Wynn's really nice room where she has the outlook and the view and it's sunny and everything. Like, that's how I picture Bajor being all over the place, you know, these wonderfully innate places, wonderful stonework and all that stuff. And this room just looks like it came straight out of the Enterprise D's, you know, cargo hold or something. It's just...
Well, isn't this the room with the filing cabinet where the city put the notice that they were going to knock down Arthur Dent's house to build a bypass?
I think I mean...
Is there a sign outside the room that says, beware of the leopard?
I couldn't be, you know, bothered to check the galactic records, so I don't really know.
All right. Well, let's close out here, because we're already about 50 minutes into this. The last thing that struck me, when we talked about the homecoming, I believe it was, or maybe it was the circle, but at the point where the Starfleet Admiral tells Sisko that you're going to have to just leave. You know, it's an internal affair. Just leave. I know we sent you there to prepare Bajor for admission into the Federation, and it's really important that we bring them in. The wormhole's super important, but nah, just go ahead and leave. I think that the way that this story ultimately resolves does support the mission of Sisko and the reason that the Federation is there, because the Federation actually helps the Bajorans get through this bump in the road of their recovery from the Cardassian occupation and get through it successfully so that they can stay on the path to eventual admission into the Federation. They almost fell into a trap where the Cardassians would have come back in. So good on Sisko for defying the order and finding a way to hang around, but also good that the writers tied it in such a way that it does make sense that the Federation is there. The Federation is lending that helping hand in the ultimate resolution of this.
It is something that I really like about this, because you know, Sisko proves to be the person who should be in charge of this mission. You know, he understands what's going on there on Bajor, obviously better than this dope admiral who's not paying attention to things. And, you know, the Bajorans had asked them to be there to help them. And when they found out that this is an undercover mission for the Cardassians to try and regain power in that area, they're definitely obliged to help their friends who have asked for assistance in rebuilding their world. It's interesting, too, because what I love here is there's no hesitation on Kira's side to not be on the side of the Federation and their help. You know, right. A year ago, she probably would have been wooed by somebody like Jero saying, we need to do this on our own. It should be for, you know, Bajor, for Bajorans. We don't need anybody else here. That's where Kira was, but she's not there anymore. And I think it's the day in, day out of seeing the benefit of having friends like the Federation there to give Bajor the time to figure its stuff out, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a really cool thing. And these episodes don't hit you over the head with it with a 2x4. It's just really nicely woven into the story that you're not even really having those conversations with Kira. The only thing she mentions is, you know, a year ago I was in a place just like this. It's not about, you know, and a year ago, I wouldn't have been standing by Captain Sisko at all. I would have been, you know, I love that, that they're not forcing that kind of thing at you. They're showing, they're not telling. That's great storytelling.
Right. All right. Well, let's close out here with the final question I have for you, which is something that we hear from people, and again, was mentioned in the Babel conference recently, but within the context of someone saying that they're really enjoying the series that we're doing on the Circle Trilogy. That's the fact that a lot of DS9 viewers dismiss these three episodes as being boring stories about the Bajorans. So now that we've been through the entire trilogy, how do you feel about that? Do you see that as being a valid view, or even though it focuses on the Bajorans, is this really important to the overall DS9 story?
No, of course, Chris. This is really important stuff for the Deep Space Nine series. It helps really formulate why, you know, Sisko's here, why the Federation's here, the importance of this mission, that they are changing a part of the quadrant. You know, I was listening to, I don't remember what I was listening to. I think I was listening to something they were talking about on Warp 5 with their Blu-ray coverage. And one of them had mentioned, you know, that so much of the 24th century was about, especially with TNG and Deep Space Nine, maintaining the Federation.
Right.
But TNG isn't that, but DS9 really is. It's about, we've said so many times, it's life in the 24th century, what it's truly like to live with these neighbors, be around, you know, these different types of people and live life in that, in the everyday. And I think that's so very cool because it gives us an opportunity to truly explore the human experience in a way that a lot of times Star Trek hadn't done as successfully as I think it thought it had, because it never allowed you to talk about issues and let them linger, you know, and this continues a really important storyline for all of Deep Space Nine as we move forward, of how you bring a society back from the brink like the Bajorans, where they had been, and how you bring a people together, how you bring peoples together like Cardassians and Bajorans later. I mean, it really is just a fantastic story, Chris. And I'm glad we talked through it because I really enjoyed watching these episodes again. And for all the talk about how gritty and whatnot Deep Space Nine is, this was a freaking funny episode for the majority of it, which was great.
Yeah, this one was quite funny.
I mean, so Deep Space Nine can tell great stories, and it doesn't just have to be dark and gritty. It can be lighthearted and fun as well, and they captured a lot of that in this. And so, all in all, it's a great three-part arc, and I wish Deep Space Nine had more three-part arcs.
Yeah, that would have been cool. Yeah, well, I mean, I think the dark and gritty comes more later in the series, so it would be interesting to see this story if it were, say, in season 6, and what the tone of it would be, because it might be a little bit darker than it is, although I think that the fun character moments would still be there. In fact, they might even be even better because the characters would be even closer to each other at that point. As to the boring Bajoran question, I think that it's really important. You know, the Bajoran stories, you may not find the Bajorans to be the most interesting race in Star Trek. You know, I don't find them to be the most interesting race in Star Trek myself, but the entire series centers around Bajor and the Bajorans and Sisko's relationship with the Bajorans and the Federation's relationship with the Bajorans. And so the events in this arc are really important to the core of the series. And so I really don't think anyone should dismiss these just because they focus on the Bajorans. So hopefully our three-part series here will help you appreciate the trilogy more. And let us know if it has. We would love to hear from you. The best place to have a discussion with us is, of course, in the Babel Conference on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook and it will come right up. That's our closed listeners discussion group. And Matthew, most people who listen probably know about it, but we get new listeners all the time. So briefly tell everyone what the Babel Conference is all about.
Well, Chris, the Babel Conference is a great place for listeners all over the network to join together and have conversation. We talk about all the different shows that we do here on the network, the episodes, the issues revolving around that, fun Star Trek things. Of course, you know, next year we'll have a new Star Trek movie, so talking about Star Trek Beyond! And then, of course, everything we talk about with the 602. So if you just like having good conversation with fun fans, come check out the Babel Conference because it really is a great place to hang out.
Yeah, absolutely. Boy, I've really started something with this Star Trek Beyond thing, haven't I? It's gone beyond me at this point.
It's your fault. It's your fault.
It's my fault.
Yeah.
Someone, I think it was Tristan or Philip, who said they want to have me saying that as a ringtone. So I might do that.
That for Patreon members.
Yeah,
there you go.
For Patreon members. When my voice gets better. My voice is not very good today. Speaking of, well, other ways to contact us before I tell you about Patreon. On Twitter, our username is TrekFM. We do have our brand page as well on Facebook, facebook.com/TrekFM. You can send us an email by going to trek.fm/contact and using the form there. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM to send us a voicemail. Now, Patreon, which we just mentioned, we're a listener-supported network, and in order to keep our programming coming, we do need your help and your support. If you enjoyed the discussion today, if you enjoy all the shows here on Trek FM, please consider supporting us through Patreon. Any amount that you want to contribute on a month-to-month basis makes a big difference for us. We have so many great patrons there, and we have lots of different opportunities for you, not only to help us cover the costs of production and distribution and hosting and everything that goes into making these shows, but also opportunities for you to get involved in the network. You can become part of the crew. You can join in the patrons' roundtable discussions. There are lots of things for you there. So please go check that out at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And we really thank you for your support. And I'd also like to thank our associate producers here on The Orb. Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. They all help us bring the show to you every week. And we really thank them for their support. And again, you can become an associate producer yourself if you would like, and you can find out about that at Patreon. Now, Matthew, if people want to get in touch with you, you know, when you're not dressing up like a Vedic so you can go hang out with Dax in the spring wine bars there on Bajor, where can people find you?
I got to say, if I'm going to a costume party with Dax, I'm happy. when that's not happening, though, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. I do that Instagrammy thing. You can find me there at MRushing. I'm also doing the 602 Club. We talked about that a little bit, what we talk about there in the Babel Conference, but the 602 Club is just a fun place to talk about non-Trek geeky things. It's a great place to have good conversation. I hope you'll join us there and take a listen to all the different things we're talking about and just trying to introduce people to some fun things they may never have tried. I do Literary Treks with Dan, Chris, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek, interview the authors. It's just a blast. I mean, we recently had Kirsten Beyer on talking about Atonement. So check that out. Really enjoy when we get to have the authors on because that's really the heart and soul of Literary Treks. And then I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Do some book reviews, movie reviews, other things. So feel free and check that anytime. Now, Chris, when you're not running around the station creating tripwires for people with your amazing stretch abilities, I mean, you're like Stretch Armstrong. Where can we find you?
I was wondering, am I like Plastic Man now?
Yeah. Wait, you're not?
That would be useful, actually, to be Plastic Man, but yeah. Anyway, you can find me here on the network doing The Ready Room, where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series, as well as Star Trek news. And I do that together with hosts from all around the network. We always have a different combination of people on that show each time. You can also find me doing Hyperchannel from time to time, which is a very short news show. Occasionally, I do Continuing Mission, and also I produce the official podcast of Axanar, all here on the network. And then if you'd like to find my writing about Star Trek, you can find that on the official website at StarTrek.com. My column there is called Trekspectives. There should be a new article out pretty soon, so keep your eyes open for that if you're interested. And then if for some reason you just like to hear me ramble on about things on the air, I have a podcast called On Air. That's Metropolis On Air, and it has nothing to do with Star Trek.
Is it a Superman podcast?
It's not, although it would be. That would be a great name for a Superman podcast.
It really would, except that you already have the name. So
I already have the name. So I interview a lot of people on that show about various topics and also talk about life in Japan, Japanese culture, some Japanese language tips, all kinds of things like that. And you can find that in iTunes or other podcast apps by searching Metropolis On Air. And you can also find it on the website, metropolisjapan.com. If you don't see it there on the front page, just type podcast into the search field and some episodes will come up. So Matthew, it was great finishing up the trilogy, but I know that one question that a lot of our listeners have is, when are you guys going to finish the season 6 opening arc series that you're doing? And the answer to that is we will continue next time.
Next time on Deep Space Nine. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.